Thank you. It's me again. This time I'm here to talk about C Sharp 4.0, which we're shipping in Visual Studio 2010. And also I'm going to give sort of a little bit of a peek and some thoughts about where we see C Sharp going beyond that. A little bit about the evolution of C Sharp. C Sharp now is actually it's amazing. It's more than 10 years old. We started in early '99, and so now we're looking at our 11th birthday. Amazingly, C Sharp 1.0 was of course about building a whole new language for a whole new platform. Managed code was the big sort of underlying theme. In C Sharp 2.0, I sort of viewed that as being the release where we added all of the things we didn't have time to add in 1.0. So in particular, generics was a big thing in C Sharp 2.0. And then 3.0, we had this fun journey into databases and queries and functional programming that all got under the theme called LINQ or Language Integrated Query. And then now, you know, we're here talking about 4.0. I talked earlier about the trends that have influenced us and continue to influence us for future versions of C#. Move towards more declarative styles of programming, the resurgence of dynamic programming languages, and concurrency, you know, the multi-core, many-core concurrency that's being foisted upon us. I thought maybe, since I already talked about those, maybe I'll talk a little bit about how we go about designing language features. It's sort of an interesting game because one of my program managers, Mats Torgerson, said, you know, about language design that I would never want to program in a language that has all the features that I want in a language, because it's always about not implementing everything that you want, because if you did, you would end up with this big mishmash of stuff. So whenever we look at how and when to add language features, it's always a very carefully and sort of judicious process that we go through. I think an interesting example is the work that we did in LINQ, which, you know, yeah, well, you've probably all seen it, you know, with the ability to write queries in the language. And in one way, we could have just sort of tried to jam SQL right into the middle of the language and connect it to a database, and then we would have had queries, and we'd be able to talk to databases. But the problem is that sort of also would inextricably tie us to the future of SQL or the future of SQL Server, and so we're always trying to look at sort of the next level up from that. You know, instead of implementing an instance of something, we're trying to implement the class of problem. And so with LINQ, we broke it down to 6 or 7 discrete features like lambda expressions, type inference, extension methods, anonymous types, and so forth, and then added those to the language, and out of that got a bunch of generality. You know, lambda expressions are great for all sorts of stuff, including language integrated query, extension methods. You can do all sorts of interesting things. But together, they come together and form a greater whole. And to me, that's sort of the hallmark of a good language feature, is that it is not just for one particular thing. It is something that is generally applicable over a bunch of different problem areas. So in C# 4.0, the biggest of the themes in there is dynamic programming. We've seen a big resurgence of interest in dynamic programming languages and use of dynamic programming languages. Arguably one of the most used languages in the world, JavaScript, is a dynamic programming language. And I've always sort of been fascinated with this this sort of unspoken rule that, you know, in order to be a dynamic programming language, you must have dynamic typing or loose typing, and then there are static programming languages, and they have strong typing. And the reality is that it doesn't have to be that way. You can actually be a statically, strongly typed programming language and yet have a very dynamic experience. You saw earlier when I demonstrated F sharp, how it really feels like a dynamic programming language, but it's actually strongly typed throughout. The features in C sharp 4 sort of boil down to four major buckets. The main one being dynamically typed objects, but then we also now in C sharp 4.0 support optional and name parameters. Interestingly, one of the most requested features, and I've tried to fight it for a long time, but I wasn't successful. We have vastly improved COM interoperability, and finally, co and contravariance for interface and delegate types. And in this talk, I'll try to take you through what these features are, do a little bit of demoing of some examples, and then there should be ample time for Q&A at the end, too. So C# 4.0 now allows you to write dynamically typed code, and it's basically does so by using the dynamic language runtime, a new feature in C# 4.0. The DLR sprang out of some work that that we've done over the years with Iron Python and Iron Ruby, two dynamic programming languages implemented on top of .NET. And in doing that work, we sort of explored quite deeply the suitability or insuitability in places of the CLR for hosting dynamic programming languages. There's a lot of good stuff in the CLR, like reflection and reflection emit and so forth, that are great sort of primitives for implementing programming languages. But dynamic languages need a lot more on top, and there's actually a lot of similarity in between them. And so with the DLR, we're adding that fabric, if you will, to the CLR, making it a better host for hosting dynamic programming languages. And so this includes things like expression trees, which actually are an evolution of the link expression trees, now grown up to also support statements and so forth. And the way we do dynamic code generation for dynamic languages is by newing up expression trees and then compiling them at runtime. On top of the DLR, we've then implemented Iron Python and Ruby, but also C#, 4.0 VB10 now use the dynamic language runtime to support their dynamic programming. And then we have binders to a variety of different object systems, like, of course, .NET, and also in Silverlight, we can talk directly to JavaScript objects. And I'll show you that as we go along. But maybe let me try and set the stage a little bit more for why we have this sort of focus on dynamic programming. Let's say here I just have a piece of regular old statically typed code. I'm newing myself up a little instance of a calculator, and my calculator has an add method that takes two integers and returns an int. And this is all good and fine, and because things are strongly typed, you know, because getCalculator returns something of type calculator, the compiler knows that there's an add method that takes two ints and it can do all the error checking and so forth. But let's say that that I am talking to some code that doesn't have a CLR class behind it. Then all of a sudden, my coding experience gets much more unpleasant. Let's say, for example, that I have a CLR object, but I don't know its class, yet I want to call its add method. Well, then it starts looking like this. I first have to get myself the calculator, then I have to get its type, then I have to call invoke member of add and new up an object array with the arguments in it, and then finally get the result back and convert that to an int. But now, say that I'm not on the CLR, but say I'm talking instead to a JavaScript calculator object that has an add method. Well, then I gotta go do similar unpleasant incantations like get a script object and then invoke the add method in strings, passing the arguments to that, and then convert the result and so forth. And what you see here is that C# is or was great at talking to statically typed things, but the minute that you got into dynamic typing, it looked ugly. Now, in C Sharp 4.0, we unify all of this under this new feature called, or this new type called dynamic. As you see here, I am calling my getCalculator method, and I am storing it in a variable of type dynamic. So what is this thing? Well, I am actually statically typing my variable to be dynamic. I hope your heads aren't exploding now, but it's because C Sharp is a statically typed language, we can use static typing to say, well, for this particular object, we want to treat it dynamically. So when I statically type something to be dynamic and I then do operations on them, they're done dynamically. So for example, the dot here that I invoke on my dynamic instance gets invoked dynamically. It gets deferred to runtime, and then the call is made then, and I'm actually permitted to write anything I want after the dot. Likewise, the result coming back is dynamically converted to type int. So I get a much gentler programming experience when I'm talking to things that are dynamically typed. So now some of you are going to say, well, have you gone mad? Haven't you taught us for 10 years that static typing is the way it ought to be, and now what's all this heresy with dynamic all of a sudden? Well, so I am specifically not telling you to go turn all of your statically typed programs into dynamic programs. I'm a deep believer in the benefits of static typing, be it, you know, from a performance perspective or from a error-checking perspective or from a tooling perspective with like things like IntelliSense and refactoring. All of these things are stem from, you know, the ability or the knowledge of strong typing. However, I think it is true that increasingly in our applications, we have to deal with things that are not strongly typed, things that are of a dynamic nature. Let's say I need to call some web service in the cloud. Well, likely I don't have a class with methods that represents this web service, yet I would like to be able to talk to it as if it were, you know, methods with parameters. Let's say I'm reading an XML document or I'm talking JSON or XML to some web service. Well, the stuff that comes back isn't strongly typed, yet why should it look different to access it? So in a sense, what I'm saying is you want to use static typing when you can, but in the cases where you can't, there's really nothing that says that those have to be unpleasant. You know, we're trying to make that a better experience. So it's really about having an appropriate tool for the appropriate scenario. Static when you can, but if not, then dynamic comes to the rescue, if you will. Let me try and drill in just a little bit deeper in how this actually works. Here, again, I have dynamic variables I'm creating. One of the things that's important to understand when looking at dynamic is the distinction between static typing or static types, compile time types, and runtime types. When I declare my variable x here, for example, I'm giving it the compile time type dynamic. So the compiler knows that x is of type dynamic. Now, when the program runs, of course, x is going to have some runtime type, in this case, int. Here, and you'll see how these two interplay. But the important thing with dynamic is to think of it as object. It's really as if I had said object x equals 1 here. I can put anything I want into a dynamic variable. Dynamic is a top type, just like object, if you will. Everything converts to dynamic. Interestingly also that dynamic converts to everything through a dynamic conversion. But here, I can put anything I want into a dynamic variable. And now, later then, when I try to do operations on the dynamic variable, such as the add call here, for example, the compiler says that if any one of the operands of an operation are of type dynamic, and in this case I have two, calc and x, then member selection gets deferred until runtime. And then at runtime, the dispatch can either happen through com. If I end up making calc, if getCalculator returns a reference to a com object, then I'm going to talk to that through idispatch. you know, behind the scenes. Or dispatch can be handled by the object itself. An object can actually implement its own dispatch, and you'll see examples of that. Or we can go through the normal C# rule. So if getCalculator simply returns some .NET object, then we will dynamically bind to it at runtime. And we will actually use the same rules that the compiler would have used at compile time, but we just substitute runtime types for all the places where we see type dynamics. So in other words, where if this had been statically typed, then the compiler would check that it would look for all the methods called add on the calculator class, and it would see that there's one that takes two ints, and then it would check that x is of type int and 10 and so forth, and it would compile it. Now, what happens if it's dynamic is that we just package it all up. And then at runtime, we do the overload resolution, but using exactly the same rules as the compiler would have used at compile time. So in a sense, we just defer the resolution to runtime. Let me just take you through one more example of what I'm talking about here. Here's the math class from the system namespace, and it has, I picked it just because it has a bunch of overloads of a single method, apps. And if I write some code here where I get myself a double and then call math.apps of x, well, then the method is chosen at compile time to be double the apps method that takes a double. But I could also write it like this, where I say, dynamic x equals 1.75, and now I am storing the runtime. I'm storing a double, a box double in my x. And if I call math.apps here, the compiler will go, x is of type dynamic, will defer it until runtime, and then at runtime we will choose the appropriate method, which in this case is the one that takes a double. But had I said dynamic x equals 2 and called math.apps of that, we would choose the one that takes an int. So we basically, at runtime, do what we normally would have done at compile time. It's possible with these dynamically typed objects or to not just call methods, as you saw me do, but also invoke properties, fields, indexers. You can apply, or I should have said, operator application there. We will actually dynamically look for something that implements operator plus and so forth. So let me try and show you what this actually looks like in real life. And you know what? I'm not sure if I have an internet connection here, and I probably should have. I forgot to plug that in. I don't know if there's someone backstage who knows about internet connectivity here. Oh, here it is. Good. There we go. Hopefully that'll work. Let me switch to Visual Studio here, and let me load up a project called Silverlight here. Here I have a little Silverlight application that maybe I should just try and run it first and pray that my connection works. Well, it doesn't yet, I can tell here. Sorry. Oh, here we go. Okay, here we go. So here's my little Silverlight app. It basically uses Silverlight to load an XML file and show it in a list box here, and then it uses the virtual Earth map, a virtual Earth map, to show the physical location of the persons that I select. And this virtual Earth map is actually a JavaScript library that my web page incorporates. So if we go back and look at if we go back and look at what the code looks like, where are we? Here. You'll see that in the web page, there's first a reference to virtual Earth here, and then we have some code down here that creates a virtual Earth map, and there's an update map method implemented in JavaScript that we can call that sets the push pin for the map. And then in Silverlight, we have our customer class here, which is just name, address, you know, et cetera, et cetera. In our main, we initialize the map and load our customers from contacts.xml. And then when they come back to us, then I parse that into a list of or a sequence of customer objects that I add to the list box's item source. And then whenever I select something in the list box, you see that I just pick out name, address, and phone, and then I set the title of my document, and I call the update map JavaScript method. Now, what you'll notice here is that there's all my C# code that looks normal, but then there are like these places where I'm calling the JavaScript code. Like here, for example, I'm htmlpage.window.invoke of create map in quotes. And this is sort of an example here of when I'm trying to call something of type, of a dynamic type, something that isn't statically typed in C#, then all of a sudden I have to use different incantations to do it, and there are limitations and so forth. Well, with C# 4.0, I can now, copy some code in here. I can declare myself two dynamic variables, htmlpage.document and window. And since these now in Silverlight 4.0 implement dynamic object dispatching, then I can now simply do dynamic dispatch off of these. So I can just say doc.createMap here, or sorry, win.createMap. And down here, instead of going through this funky set property guy, I can just say doc.title equals blah, 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 blah. And I can say win.updateMap. And you'll see when I say win dot, win is typed to be dynamic, so I don't get statement completion here because we don't know what's available. We don't have a type for it, but I'm basically permitted to write anything I want. So I can say win.updateMap, and then I can just take the rest of this here, like so, and just go through dynamic dispatch. And if we run, we'll see that, we'll hopefully see something. Yeah, I got some flaky internet connectivity here, unfortunately. Oh, sorry, it's up. It's over here. There we go. Here we see, again, the same app. Okay, now, let's try something different here. Now, you saw that I had this bit of JavaScript that I was calling from C#, and I now actually get a nicer experience calling it. But the funny thing is, too, that if you look at it, actually, this JavaScript code looks an awful lot like C# code, doesn't it? So maybe we could try to actually copy that and then just put it in our C# here instead and see if we can get away with it. Well, we get some errors. So let's see if we can fix this up. So in JavaScript, var means anything. So the equivalent in C# is dynamic. So we'll just change that to be of type dynamic. Whoops. And then here we have the JavaScript create map. Well, we don't say function in C#. We say void. And then here there's a new, but this is a JavaScript new, and we want to change it into some C# code here. And we can do that by calling win.create instance of, and then say we want to create an instance of the JavaScript VE map passing the argument map. And then down here, here's update map. And now you see in JavaScript, you don't have to give types to your parameters, but C# requires me to. But of course, the type can be dynamic. So I can just add dynamic to each of these guys. There we go. And things, you know, all the syntax errors go away except for the last one here where we need to say create instance because we're creating a JavaScript instance, not a .NET instance, like so. And now we've actually transformed the JavaScript code into C#. And of course, now we just need to make sure that we call that. So since these are now methods in my class, To invoke them, I simply call my own methods, create map, and then down here, I just call the update map, like so. And maybe we should just set the title to from C sharp colon on the push pin, just so we can see that we did indeed come from C sharp. So let's try to run this. And here we go, and now as we're clicking, the map moves, and if we hover, we'll see that this actually ran in C sharp. So we successfully turned JavaScript into C sharp. So you see, with these new dynamic features, the two languages are much, much closer together, and it's much, much easier to interoperate between the two of them. All right. Let me go back to the slides here. Actually, no, I wanted to show one more example. Let's try to open another solution here. And let me try and show you a little bit of interoperability between C sharp and another dynamic programming language, in this case, Python. Here I have a project that includes a little Python calculator a file here that defines a calculator class and defines a method called getCalculator that allows me to get an instance of a calculator. Let me try now to interoperate with that or call that from C sharp. And to do that, I will first get myself a line of code here that creates an instance of the Python runtime. So I new up the Python runtime, and then I tell it to load the calculator class. And now I'm good to go. I can say dynamic calc equals Python dot. And you'll see here, again, Python is of type dynamic, so I don't get statement completion because we don't know what the types are. But I can simply call get calculator. Like so. And now I'm holding an instance of the Python calculator. Now let me try to write some code to use it. So say for int I equals 1 to 10, say. Maybe we want to say int sum equals calc.add of I comma 10, I comma 100, say. And then console.write line of sum. So here you see, I'm calling the Python method add and whatever. Let's try and run it. And sure enough, we see the numbers from 100 to 109. And yet this looks totally integrated. I didn't have to go through special incantations to call that Python code. Now, the thing that's interesting actually about the Python code, if you look at it, is that in Python, Python is dynamically typed, so there are no types on the variables. The variables can be anything. In fact, I could go back and change my program to pass a double for the second argument there, and if I run it, it all doesn't work out because I now have to store my result that came back as a double. It was, hey, dynamic typing, so you get dynamic runtime errors there. So now it works on doubles, the same piece of Python code, because, you know, it's dynamically typed. Indeed, I could go a little bit crazy here and maybe use date time sum equals, and then let's say add to date time dot today. Actually, we'll do it the other way around, say, the sum of datetime.today plus timespan dot from days of I, for example. And because datetime implements an operator plus that takes a datetime and a timespan, hey, that'll work out on the Python side because you said plus, and there is an operator plus available. So you see here how we get deep integration between these two languages, yet all of the features that you're used to are still available through the dynamic language runtime. Okay, let me go back to the slides here. So that's a quick look at dynamically typed objects. Let me just sort of round out by talking about how objects themselves can implement their dynamic dispatch. One of the classes that we include in .NET 4.0 is system.dynamic.dispatch. dynamic object, which is a base class that you can use to derive your own dynamic objects. And what characterizes a dynamic object is that it handles its own dispatch of members. So you'll see here that, for example, there's a try get member that I can override, and I can implement my own member access. A try invoke member, I could implement my own method calls, get property, that would be get member. I can implement my own conversions and so forth. And let me actually try to show you what that looks like in real life. So let me open another little program here. So here we have a blank program. About the only thing that's different here about from that is that I'm importing system.dynamic. Now let me try and implement a dynamic object myself. So I'm going to just paste in here my little class bag. I'm going to implement a property bag, which inherits from dynamic object and handles its own get and set member operations. So whenever you try to assign to a property or get a property on this guy, these methods get invoked. And inside my bag, I simply have a dictionary going from string to object that stores the names of the members that you put into it and the values. And in the set member, I jam in a property using the name that got passed to me and the value. And in get member, I try to get it out of the dictionary again. And with that in hand, I can now write code like dynamic x equals new and new myself up a bag. And you'll see here what I do is I new up a bag but store it in something typed as dynamic. So now when I dot off of my x, it's actually dynamic dispatch. So I could say x.id equals 12345, x.name equals lawnmower, x.category equals gardening, and maybe finally x.price equals 645.95 decimal here. Let me add a little bit more code to my bag here. I'll paste in a toString method. In fact, I'll add a method called toXML on my bag that creates an XML representation of my dictionary just by sticking all the items into an XML element. And then I'll do a toString that just calls toXML. And so now I can actually just console.writeline my X here. And if we try to run, let me try and figure out where I did. Oh, what did I do wrong here? I got rid of something there that I shouldn't have. There we go. Let's try and run it again. Okay, I'm having fun here. Sorry. Okay, here we go. Let's run it. And here you see my little bag come out as XML. Okay, now let me try to just say to actually access some of these properties. So I'm going to say the price of one x.name is plus x.price here. So here you see me set members. Down here I'm getting members dynamically again. And if we run this, we'll see the price of one lawnmower is blah, 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 blah. And all of this went through dynamic dispatch on my object. Now, let me just try to do something else here, too. Let me refactor this into a separate method. I'll extract a method from that line there, and I'll call it writeBag. And you'll see that we actually figure out that the static type of X is dynamic. So we'll make a method that takes a dynamic X and then accesses the name and price members on it. Now let me try and make myself another kind of member. Maybe I'll make a strongly typed one here. Let me paste in a product class, for example. And then let me make an instance of a product. We'll say var shovel equals new product. Here we go. And then we'll say name equals, name equals shovel, comma, price equals 1,1250 decimal, for example. There. And now let me try to say write back of my shovel. So here we have two different implementations, or two here. In the first case, I'm passing my property bag dictionary X, but down here I'm just passing an instance of some CLR object. But both of them have a name and a price property, and that's all that's required here for this code to work, because I'm doing dynamic dispatch and I'm doing it against different kinds of objects. In one case, the object handles the dispatch itself. In the other case, I'm just using a regular CLR object. Okay, so that gives you an idea of how you can implement your own dynamic objects. We actually ship an object called Expando Object with .NET 4.0 that's very much like this bag here, a little property bag that so you don't even have to write that thing yourself. And it turns out to be very useful in dynamic scenarios where you don't really know what types are going to be available, or you don't know the schema of some XML you're reading or whatever. Okay. Moving right along to the next feature, optional and named parameters. This has been sort of a long-standing request from the community. We never put them into the language to begin with, but here they are now. But let me set the stage here. It's very common in .NET and C# to declare methods that have several arguments, and because they have these several arguments, you kind of want to be able to default some of them. So maybe there's a primary method here that takes all the arguments, and then there's a set of secondary overloads that call the primary method supplying the default argument. So we sort of, you end up defining these families of methods that gradually omit the arguments. Now, with optional parameters, you can instead just supply the default parameters, the default values in the signature. And with that, you can then now write invocations where these defaults are automatically passed. So for example, I can call open text file of foo.text and encoding.utf8 and omit the last two parameters, and the compiler will automatically insert true and 1024. I could also use named arguments. So here is an example of passing the first two by position, and then passing the omitting the detect encoding, and then passing buffer size as 4096. Now, named arguments must be last in a method call. I can actually kind of go crazy and only supply named arguments in out of order. So here, for example, I'm calling open text file. I'm passing buffer size, path, and encoding. And in this case, I'm permitted to put them in any order, but I must always specify the ones that are not optional because we don't have default values for them. Now, all of this, what it boils down to is just that the compiler will do sort of the appropriate reordering and the appropriate filling in based on the default values that you specified. So that's named and optional parameters. Let me talk about improved com interoperability and then give you an example of both of them together. Let me first, how many of you have written code like this before? Yeah, way too many. This is sort of the unfortunate interplay between old COM automation servers and .NET and some missing features here. Because we have not supported default parameters and named or an optional parameters in C#, whenever you use, like, say, the word automation model, which you could argue is maybe not the most brilliantly written API, but nonetheless, there it is. And there are methods like save as that take 16 arguments, all of which are optional and must be specified by reference, believe it or not. And if you don't want to give any of them, you still have to give all 16 and say that they're missing. And that's obviously a horrible experience. So my deepest apologies. You don't have to write that anymore. With C# 4.0, ta-da, you can actually write doc.saveAsText.doc. And let me try to show you that let me talk a little bit about it, and then I'll show you that in action. The improved COM interoperability we get from a couple of things. First of all, we now support optional and named parameters, and that helps a lot because a lot of these old Olay automation servers use those features. We also support indexed properties, which is a COM-only thing. We make the ref modifier optional when you're talking to COM interop libraries. And then finally, we have a new feature called interop type embedding, or also known as the no PIA, or no primary interop assembly feature. Up until now, it was the case that if you wanted to talk to any Olay code like Excel or Word or PowerPoint or any one of those automation servers, you had to have a primary interop assembly for that thing. And a primary interop assembly is basically a bunch of type declarations that declares the .NET metadata for that COM object. Now, with C# 4.0, you do not have to include these primary interop assemblies at runtime. Instead of compiling the code such that it references the interop assembly, we can actually take types out of the interop assembly and put them in your code, embed them directly in your code. So at the end of the day, all you deploy is your code and none of the PIAs. And let me try and show you what that actually looks like in real life. Let me open up. I have a project here that shows some Office interoperability. Let me try and run it here, and you can see. Well, I'll explain, actually. It first opens up an Excel spreadsheet. Then it runs a little link query to query all the running processes and takes the top 10 of those, gets the process name and working set size, sticks it into a spreadsheet. Then invokes the Excel chart wizard to make a chart out of that, and then takes that chart and puts it into a Word document. So let's try and run that and just see it in action. Here's the Excel spreadsheet. Here's the chart, and here's the chart pasted into a Word document. And we can observe that by far the biggest consumer is DevEnv, but that should come as no surprise. Let's try to exit out of all of this stuff. Now, looking at this code, this is not at all pretty. If you look at all the sort of strange incantations you have to go through, I even tried to format it nice so it looked nice, but even so, workbooks.add of type.missing. Here, get cells, cast it to excel.range, and then set the value to property. For some strange reason, the value property doesn't work. Do the same here. Call the chart wizard passing missing, comma sheet, comma missing, comma missing, or this guy missing, 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 missing. I mean, God knows which argument is what here. And down here is the big kicker, you know, where I have to create a missing variable and pass that by reference four times. Clearly, we can do better. let me try and just pin this and the property inspector here and show you. In the references of this project, I'm referencing office.core and interop for Excel and Word. And if you look down at the property inspector, you'll see that for these assemblies, there's a new property called embed interop types, which is set to false by default because we're doing it the old way. But if I change this to true, then a couple of things happen. First of all, we tell the compiler now that when you compile this code, don't make references to the primary interop assemblies. Instead, extract the types I'm using out of the interop assemblies and just put them in my code. So there will be no need to deploy the interop assembly later. Second thing we do also is when you import all of that COM metadata, use type dynamic instead of type object. And so all the places where we previously would have used system.object, we now use dynamic. And that gives you dynamic dispatch off of all of these COM objects. And it basically makes it all work the way that it was intended to. So now I can start cleaning up my app here. First, I can get rid of the type.missing guy there. Here, I may just copy that so you don't have to watch my horrible typing. Here, I can just change this to simply be excel.cells.value. Likewise, down here, I can change this to some sane-looking code. In the place where I add my chart, it now becomes much shorter. Simply call charts.add, and then the only argument I'm passing is the after argument, and I specify that by name, and then what value I'm passing. Here where I'm invoking the chart wizard, I can get rid of all of this stuff and just pass source and title as named arguments. And then finally down here where we have all this crazy stuff with type.missing, I can just get rid of all of that and just call document.add. And let's try and run, and ideally we see the same result. First Excel, then our chart, then paste it into Word. But this time, if we go back and look at the code, this actually looks the way it was intended to be. And this is all through a confluence of features like dynamic, named and optional parameters, the interop embedding, and so forth. And if you were to look at the XE that got produced here, you'll see that XE does not require the Word and Excel interop assemblies to be present any longer. Okay, let me close this guy and go back to the slides again. Final feature I wanted to talk about is co and contravariance. Here's a little bit of code where I knew myself a string array, and then I call a method called process, and I pass my strings. And my process method, in order to be maximally applicable, takes an object array and then operates on this object array. Now, in .NET, arrays are covariant. So when I have myself a string array, I'm actually allowed to pass it as an object array, because string inherits from object, and therefore also string array is convertible to object array. That's covariance. Now, the thing that's interesting about the covariance in .NET arrays is that it is not safely covariant. There's actually a hole in the typing here. Let me illustrate how that works out. If in my process method I say object sub 0 equals hello, then all is dandy because I'm trying to put a string into a string array. But if I try to put a button into object sub 1, then the compiler will happily compile this. But at runtime, I'm going to get an exception saying you can't put buttons into a string array. So interestingly, even though we have covariance, there's actually some type checking that's missing, and that has to happen at runtime. And indeed, for an array of reference types, every time you store into an array of a reference type, we do a dynamic check that the thing you're storing in there is actually compatible with the runtime type of the array. Now, let's say I had written this using generics instead of arrays. Let's say I had a list of strings, and then let's say I called the process method, and let's say in the process method, to make it maximally applicable, I had written it so that it takes an enumerable of objects, so I could pass a collection of any kind and of the least possible derived type. Now, until now, C# generics have been invariant, so this would not compile. I would get an error here saying strings is not an enumerable of object. It's an enumerable of string, but not object, which was infuriating. Why? What do you mean? It's like if it's a string, why can't I treat it as an object? And indeed, in C# 4.0, you can, and we now support safe covariance, safe co and contravariance, actually. So this error goes away, and this becomes possible. And now you can wonder, well, if arrays had a problem, you know, and needed some dynamic type checking, why is it that you say now that this is safe? Well, if you think about the IEnumerable interface, one key characteristic of IEnumerable is that there's no way of putting values into any element of the IEnumerable. IEnumerable is purely for taking things out of the collection. It only returns me things. And surely, returning strings as objects is a safe thing, right? There's nothing that can go wrong there. The place where it goes wrong is if I were to try to put things in there, because if I try to put buttons into something that the compiler thinks is an object enumerable, that would go wrong. So let's look at how this actually is implemented in C# 4.0. So here's how traditionally IEnumerable of T was defined. And now, in C# 4.0 and .NET 4.0, you are permitted to modify your type declaration, your type parameters, with an in or an out modifier. So notice again what happened here. Instead of IEnumerable of T, it becomes IEnumerable of out T. And out indicates covariance. So when you put an out modifier on a type parameter, you're saying this type parameter is covariant. And when a type parameter is covariant, you are only permitted to use it in output positions. And it so happens that in enumerable and enumerator, we only use T in an output position, so we can safely add that modifier. But the compiler will now check that you only return T's, that you never have anything that takes a T. And because of that, we can now treat an IEnumerable of string as an IEnumerable of object. Specifically, we can treat things as less derived safely and not need any dynamic runtime checks like we did with arrays and instead get things reported as compile time errors. We also support the opposite of covariance, contravariance, and as you might guess, that's the in modifier. So we can put an in modifier on a type argument. And that means that this type is an input type and can only be used in input positions. And in this particular case here, for our comparer, we're only ever passing T's in. We're never getting them out. And now, with contravariance, it goes the other way around. We can create a comparer of objects, but then we can use it as a comparer of strings. And if you think about it, you can see how, yes, this is safe, because, you know, surely we can treat strings as objects we can treat strings as objects for comparison purposes, and we haven't run into any typing holes. So that's what that feature looks like. Covariance and contravariance is supported for interface types and delegate types. And if you want the technical term for what we implement, it's called statically checked definition side variance. If you're a type system wonk, Java actually implements co and contravariance, but they introduce it through this feature called wildcards, and they also have use site variance, which I think everyone at this point agrees was probably a bit overkill, you know, and ends up being rather complicated. I think we've struck a nice balance here. In .NET 4.0 and C# 4.0, value types are always invariant, just as with arrays. So an IEnumerable of int cannot be treated as an IEnumerable of object, just like an int array can't be treated as an object array, because representationally they're different. And finally, ref and out parameters always need an invariant type. In the framework itself, we have now put variance annotations on a number of types. In particular, IEnumerable and IEnumerator are important. And then all in the delegate family, all the func and action delegates have the appropriate variance annotations on them. Now, so just backing up from all this co-contravariance, and maybe some of you are going, what is he talking about here? I don't get it. You know, the good thing about co and contravariance is you don't really have to necessarily get how it works deeply. Rather, you can simply observed that in cases where you went, why did this not work? It now works. You can treat your string lists as innumerables of objects in link, and it will actually work out where previously it didn't. And that's really sort of the most important part of this feature. Okay. So that was C Sharp 4.0. Let me now talk a little bit about some of the things we see coming in the future. Earlier, I sort of alluded to this thing called compiler as a service. And just sort of to briefly recap, a thing that we're working on currently is a rewrite of our C Sharp and VB compilers in managed code. It turns out that both of them are written today in C++. You go, well, why is that? Well, it's because when we wrote them, we didn't have .NET, and so we couldn't write them in C#, and so we wrote it in C++, and then by the time we'd written it, we didn't throw it away. And we've continued to evolve that code base, but it's getting to be a bit of a millstone. It's tough to work on, you know, it's a bit crusty, and it doesn't do a lot of the things that we would like it to do, and modifying it to do them is painful. In particular, we observe more and more that the traditional view of a compiler as a thing that takes source files in one side and spits assemblies out on the other side is getting to be outdated. We sure would like to have an interactive prompt in C# where you can just type code and have it work just like in a dynamic language. We want to enable the ability to put C# code snippets into domain-specific languages like Workflow or BizTalk or what have you, and have them use the compiler to compile that code dynamically at runtime. We want users to be able to write their own refactorings and plug them into the IDE so that we don't have to write every one of them, or you don't have to go buy them from third parties. And all of these things and many more require that we, in a sense, open up the compiler and allow some of the compiler's knowledge about the code to be accessible through APIs. And that's really what part of this endeavor is about. And by opening up the compiler, we will enable a lot of these scenarios that I talk about, like metaprogramming. We will have a language object model that has full fidelity for the programming language, where literally we have complete 100% accurate representation in an object model of a C# program, and allows you to do transformations on them and ask questions about typing and so forth. In addition, I should say that this rewrite of our compilers also, longer term, is we intend to be able to better harness concurrency. Our current compiler is written in a way where it would be very, very hard to use concurrency. Yet, if you look at C#, and one of the nice features about C# is that there's no declaration order dependencies anywhere in the language, or very few places in the language. And that means that we can actually highly parallelize compilation of C# code. If you're compiling 100 C# source files, well, first of all, we could individually parse them concurrently and then, you know, get the parse trees and all produced because they're all independent. But we could also concurrently compile all of the method bodies one by one and do type binding and IL emit concurrently, because there are no interdependencies between them. But it takes for the compiler to be built in a more modern way, and that and part of that is also what we're doing. Let me try to just give you a brief preview of what this looks like. I have here it's actually a prototype of some of this, so it's not the code that we're currently implementing, but it doesn't really matter. It's the same idea. Here I have a little project that uses a C# evaluator, and you can sort of think of this as the dynamic language eval equivalent, but for C#. If you drill into our C# evaluator, you'll see that it has a couple of properties. It has a list of usings and a list of references that I can set, and then an eval method that takes a string and evaluates. Well, it compiles it and runs it and returns the result as an evaluation result, which is either an object, the value that got produced, or a list of errors. And this guy takes a C-sharp compiler as an argument, and the C-sharp compiler has a bunch of compile methods and so forth. And you sort of see how this is really the C-sharp compiler as an API that's usable from your program. So let's try and use it. For example, here I'm doing up an eval, an evaluator, and adding a reference to the system namespace. And now I can simply say ev.eval. And then let me try and write as a string for int I equals 0, I less than 10, I plus plus, console.writeline of I times I. There. And let's try and run it. And here you see my for loop compiled at runtime and then running. So really, C-sharp, but used in a much more dynamic fashion. I can actually use this guy to even declare a little function. Let's declare int square of int x, return x times x, like so. And then down here, I could modify this guy to use square of x instead. And if we try to run that, then we get the, whoops, we don't get anything. Did I do something wrong here? Oh, square of I, sorry, yep. As you see, my example here doesn't print out the errors. There was an error there, but I didn't print it out. So there we go. Thank you for that background syntax checking there. That was very useful. see, that's why I should all be statically typed. Yeah. Anyway. let me try to do some little more crazy things with this thing here. Let me grab first add another reference here to the system.core assembly. And then let me try to modify my code here to do some wonky stuff. So now I call my eval and I define a square function. And then what I evaluate next is I create a delegate to that function that I just dynamically compiled. And then I return that as the value, as the result of my eval. And then I take that delegate over here in my strongly typed program and store it in my variable f. And then I implement a for loop that calls the delegate. So now I'm calling code that was just compiled, if you will. So I'm mixing the two worlds, in a sense. And you see that it all still works out. So you can truly dynamically extend running programs and compile little pieces into them and then in a strongly typed fashion get access to them as well. Now, one of the things, of course, that we can do with stuff like this is we can implement something like an interactive prompt. And let me try and do that here. I'll first just paste in a little class that implements a user interface thread. Forget about what it really does here. It just allows me to run UI code or run code on the user interface thread. There's nothing other than that that's interesting. But now let me try to turn this thing into an interactive prompt. So I add a bunch of references to assemblies here and a bunch of usings. And here is the main loop for my REPL, where I new up a UI thread, and then I just console.write C-sharp here, and then read some stuff from the console. And then while the user typed something, if what he typed is not complete yet, so there's a method on my evaluator that tells me whether it's a complete program, but if it's not, then prompt for more and eat that until we have something that's complete, and then run that on the UI thread and print the result. So let's try and run. And now we have ourselves a little interactive prompt here where I can type C-sharp like math.squirt up to and so forth. And, of course, it doesn't have statement completion or anything, but you could easily imagine that being built with these same services as well. Let me try and show you some of the funny things you can do with something like this. Let me tile these two windows here. Whoop, not this guy. Okay, now I've got window-itis here. Sorry. Let's minimize this guy and tile these guys here. There we go. Okay, now let's try to just copy pieces of code from up here and paste them in here. So we can do console.writeline, sure. We can have a for loop. There we go. We can define a factorial function, say, there, and then we can call it fac of 5, fac of 10, etc. We could define a little print method here, and then we can, for example, for each all of the files in the Windows directory, or we could call check how many processes are running on this box. We could write a link query here, like what are the top processes running here. Again, you'll see devenv is a little suspicious there. But we could also do, because I'm running on the UI thread and that's why I had to put that thing in, we can new up a form. Here we have a form with its topmost bit set, so it stays on top of everything else. And then we can put a background image in this guy, like that. And then we can put a little button in it. Thank you. We can put a button in it that now we can click, but hey, we can also add an event handler to the button. There. That does a console.write line here. And now when we click it, it writes in my console window. Thank you. So as you can see, this is useful stuff that we're hoping to ship as soon as we can. I can't tell you exactly when, but we're working on it. So that's the end of my talk, and I'd be happy to take questions here for the last 10 minutes or so if you have any. I don't know if there are microphones anywhere that otherwise people can just holler them out, and I'll try to repeat the questions. Yeah, there's one over here. Link over dynamic objects possible? Yes, it is. And it's just, you know, yeah. You can write link queries that work on dynamic objects. Yeah. Well, it depends. So you can use link to objects to do anything you want with these dynamic objects. But if you're using link to SQL, you're not going to have the necessary metadata available. So, you know, link to SQL or the entity framework won't know how to map your dynamic object into a table, you know. So there are certain things that aren't possible, but you know, within reason, yes, you can do it. There's one over here. Right. So the question is, in some dynamic languages, you can change methods on your dynamic objects. The dynamic language runtime supports that, you know, but it's sort of, in a sense, up to the implementation of dynamic object, whether it permits it. You could write a dynamic object that does anything you want, including the ability to substitute methods, and you know, you can store them as delegates or whatever. You can't add methods to existing CLR objects. So if you take an existing CLR instance and treat it as dynamic, you can't all of a sudden add new methods to that one. But you could write an encapsulation of it that stores a reference to that object and implements dynamic object, and then you can do, again, whatever you want. So certainly, you can talk to languages like JavaScript.NET or Python or whatever that have these capabilities from C#, and you can indeed even sort of cause some of these things to happen from a C# program, but just not on regular objects as such. Yep, there's one here. Are we implementing JavaScript on a DLR? Good question. We actually have an implementation of JScript.NET. We're thinking about what to do with it. The JavaScript engine in IE9 is not built on top of the DLR for a couple of reasons, I should say. One is expediency. You know, they wanted to get competitive as fast as possible, and the fastest path for them is to evolve the existing JavaScript engine. A second reason I would say is that When the market situation is as competitive as it is in the current JavaScript engine wars with V8 and TraceMonkey and JaegerMonkey or whatever they're all called, these new JavaScript engines, there comes a point where if you want to eke out the last 10 to 50%, you really sort of have to get down and dirty and optimize for JavaScript. And JavaScript has some wonky capabilities, like the ability to just add properties at will and doesn't have class declarations, and so you need to get in and do stuff like V8 does with hidden classes. And all of those things are sort of force you to write specifically for JavaScript. So for those reasons, the IE9 JavaScript engine is not built on top of the DLR. But we do have a JavaScript implementation on top of the DLR, just not the one that goes in IE9. Down here. Why can't IntelliSense be dynamic on dynamic keyboards? Well, it could, but only if you can relate the thing to an existing instance that you can ask what method it has. So it's like when something is of type dynamic, you don't know what it's going to reference, and you don't know what methods that thing will have. It's like it's of type object. And an object can be referencing a button or a string or an HTTP connection, or you don't know. So you don't know what methods to show in IntelliSense unless you perhaps have a live instance. And in that case, sometimes you can show it, or sometimes you can infer it from the program. You can sort of look at all the places that the variable was assigned and what is, and guess at what the type was. But generally speaking, you can't know. And that's why we can't give you IntelliSense, because we don't know what to give you. That's sort of one of the big differences between static typing and dynamic typing. With static types, we know what the type is. With dynamic, we don't. Yeah? Yeah, I can't quite hear what you're saying. So is with the dynamic capabilities, are F-sharp and C-sharp converging? I wouldn't say so. I they're two distinct languages. I think, and they're going to continue to coexist. F-sharp is going to be specifically aimed at functional programmers, people that want that sort of functional feel to a programming language. C-sharp, we're not going to try to materially change the feel of the language. We're going to adopt things from functional programming languages like you saw us do in C#3.0, and we'll continue to look at that. I want us to look more deeply at supporting immutability. It's too hard to write immutable objects today, and I want to make that easier. So we're going to look at converging the capabilities, but not the feel of the two languages. Oh, can you use dynamic types with extension methods? Yes, but with some limitations. I mean, we will actually. Well, actually, now I have to be careful here, and make sure I don't promise. I'm not exactly certain to what extent. I mean, we do capture in the calls in a dynamic call site what extension methods were in scope, and I do believe that we consider those. But that doesn't mean that if you then hand that object off to Python, that Python will see those extension methods, because it's a C# thing. If you see what I'm saying, so it may not work exactly as you think, but it will work if you're in C#. Yeah. Let me go down here. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I stated that IEnumerable is now covariant. Is that also the case for IObservable? I believe it is, but don't quote me on it. But I think it is. Yeah. I'll take maybe a couple more. Yeah. Right. So what are the speed differences between static and dynamic? So earlier in my keynote, I talked a little bit about some of the things that cause dynamic languages to run slowly, and that is true too, or slower, and that is true too with the DLR, although the DLR does a lot to optimize it. So it depends. If you're using the dynamic capabilities, but you're talking from, you know, one statically typed piece of code to another, let's say you have type dynamic, but and you're invoking a method, but the method you're invoking is just a regular old CLR method over on the other side, and the arguments you pass have the correct types, then the DLR will actually arrange to plumb the call straight through. And because we do inline caching of method lookup, we will actually remember the last lookup, and if you have a loop that calls the same thing a million times, yes, it'll be just like calling through a delegate. So we'll make it about as efficient as we can. But of course, if what you're calling on the other side is a Python object or a Ruby object, well, then you're going to see, you know, the performance characteristics of those languages. So, but the potential for it to be super fast is there and will be realized in cases where we can. So the DLR does some pretty nifty things with generics in order to preserve types and in order to avoid boxing of arguments and so forth. All right, let me take one last question and then end. Let's take one here, yeah. Yes, so the question is, I showed embedding types from a primary interop assembly. Can you do that from any assembly? Yes, you can, but there are some limitations on what. It's only interfaces and struct types and enums and so forth, and there are some rules about how it works, but you can actually use it to unify two interfaces in two different assemblies based on a GUID without actually having to do a bunch of other COM stuff as well. So, and we do see this becoming a more full-fledged feature over time. Right now, the primary intent is to ease COM interoperability, but certainly there are other interesting uses, like in MEF, for example, the extension framework, where, you know, we'd be able to unify interface types structurally in a sense. So that's something that we're looking at also. Okay, I think I'm out of time, so I want to thank you for coming, and hope you enjoy C# 4.0. Thank you. Thanks.